Hi there. This is Nick Savvides. You're listening to the NSavvides podcast. This is a show where we talk about the art of collaboration, of working together to do great, creative, imaginative things. And sometimes we talk about how to make the world a little better as well. This episode is my coverage of Louisiana International Film Fest 2017. This year's coverage will be a little different, but still interesting, I hope. I have a musician connected to a documentary about New Orleans, a filmmaker with three different projects at the festival, an actor who's also connected to the festival, working for them as their operations director. We also talked to the production director, Jason Allen, and the executive director, Chesley Himesfield. How's it different? Well, we have more people from the festival itself than I usually do on my festival coverage, but this will give us an insider's view of what goes on in running a festival and how we can interact with it, how we can have better collaborations with the festival itself. Some of the things we discuss in this episode include how the music community in New Orleans is still trying to survive and recover from Katrina. Important things to keep in mind when submitting a film to a film festival, leveraging the festival to create opportunities, an important lesson learned from my past film project, some of the festival films and memorable events that stuck out for people, and what goes into bringing a special guest, notable person, to a film festival, like, say, Renee Zellweger, who did make a special appearance at LIFT 2017. All that and more coming up next. Stick around.
This is the NSavvides podcast.
Hello, hello, hello. Our first interview is with Barry Martin, a New Orleans musician who was born in London. We are joined by Sally Young, host of Traditional Jazz, a radio program on WWOZ in New Orleans. They discuss with me their participation in the documentary One Note at a Time, a film that explores the music community post-Katrina and how the Musicians Clinic tries to provide health care for musicians in need. Tell us about your involvement. How'd you all get connected with this film?
Well, this lady from London called, Renee Edwards, her name is, and she came to the house and said she was going to make a film about New Orleans music, and I don't think she had decided it was going to be for the Musicians Clinic, do you?
Not in the beginning. No. I think that evolved over time.
Yeah. And so she said, you know, you're from the same place as I am, because she's from London, England, and I was born in London, although I've been here since 61. And she said, will you help me? Well, what are you going to say to a lady? You know, I said, yeah, I guess so. So I started introducing her to different people. And then I think she got hooked up with the Musicians Clinic. And then it became a film about that, which was good, you know. So it all changed around. That's about the way I see it. And you?
Yeah. She filmed it, I think, over a course of 4 years. And it took her a number of trips to New Orleans from England to come in. And as you could see, they captured different moments, different trips. But compiling that must have been a real director's nightmare because she had a lot of film to choose from. But I think she told a good story. She wanted to put together the story of recovery in New Orleans after Katrina and through the eyes of mostly musicians, but the culture bearers of New Orleans.
And she had a real good cameraman, Mr. Chad. He's from Houston, isn't he?
Yeah, they had Chad, and there's another guy, Mike. I forget their last names, but different trips she would have different guys. But, yeah, they did a wonderful job.
Yeah, that was one of the most impressive things about that, the close-ups of the music. I mean, I know most of the musicians, you know, like Wardell Kazare that was in that. He died. He must have filmed that just almost on his night. He died, I think, you know. And I mean, I knew Wardell from 61, a long time. But I hadn't seen him for about 40 years, and then along he comes to the Musicians Clinic. And he didn't know me at first, but I knew him. He looked older. Well, 40 years will do it, you know. But so you renewed. But the bass player, Walter Payton, in that film, he used to live downstairs from me, you know. He had one of my apartments. And so we used to We'll get a big kick out of him. Sent us to sleep at night playing that bass.
Yeah, I think that was one of the most poignant parts of the movie, was watching musicians that we knew and that had worked with us, and that they had passed away during the course of the filming. Of course, I told you it took over 4 years. But Uncle Lionel Batiste was in the film a number of times. Walter Payton, Herman Ernst, was Dr. John's drummer, and Wardell. And Wardell, because there's at least four that have passed since the beginning of the filming.
Yeah, that was pretty powerful to see. So you all are both intimately connected with the music scene in New Orleans. And I was wondering if you could talk about that and what the community means to you all.
Well, I didn't really know Miss Sally until I was outside the grocery store smoking my cigar. And she came by and said, "Do you know a banjo player called George Gaynor, who died in 68? I said, "Yeah, he was a good friend of mine." She said, "Well, would you be prepared to come on a radio show and talk about him?" And I said, "Well, yeah, you know, I don't do radio shows much, but it wasn't about me and it wasn't about her. It was about this banjo player." And so I did it. And she said, "How long can you talk about George Gaynor?" I said, "Well, how long's your show?" But it was an hour and a half, wasn't it? And since then, we've been to a lot of jazz things together. And now we're in the process of making a film about a alto player from New Orleans called Harold Dejean, who started the Olympia Brass Band. And she's the narrator, and I'm one of the interviewees.
Oh, this is another film project?
Yeah. And
these films are a little different that we're working on. They're for the Tulane Hogan Jazz Archive and the Historic New Orleans Collection. They'll never be sold or distributed. They are for research purposes. So they'll be housed in those archives. So, Barry's been a drummer for most of his life. He started in the UK, and then he moved here in 1961 to New Orleans, and he's been involved in traditional jazz all of his life and played with a lot of the old legendary players that are pretty much all dead and gone by now, but he has a lot of history recording them, playing with them, touring worldwide with them, so, you know, he's a legend unto himself by now, because he's brought all of them.
The nicest things you say, the nicest things.
Yeah, you brought all of these people back into prominence, and I mean, because of your expertise with the music business, and you know, some of the names that we know now, were thanks to him.
And Sally, you're also doing music coverage full time for the radio station, right? WWOZ. So, talk a little bit about getting to know the New Orleans music community from that angle.
Okay, yeah, I do a traditional jazz show on WWOZ radio in New Orleans, and I always was connected to the music community through things like Jazz Fest Foundation, and a lot of the events that I work year-round, which are all music-related, have a long history with that, and also the theaters. I do a lot of work in the theaters in New Orleans. You know, I'm in not so much acting, but in music, you know, concert-wise, symphony-wise, ballet and opera, all those, I'm involved in all that.
Oh, wow, that's like all the different textures of the music, yeah.
The cultural arts, yeah. Yeah, on radio I do traditional jazz, but in the rest of my life, my day job, I do a lot of other things. So, I've always been involved in music all my adult life. And, yeah, work with a lot of musicians in town. Most of the people in the movie I know. I think Barry knows a good number of them, too. But
she knows more than I do. She knows many more musicians than I know because of her radio show. It's always on every Thursday morning from 9 to 11, and she gets all kind of musicians to come on it and talk and do all this stuff, you know. As me, I just play music, and but I've been lucky. I've had a good career playing music, but I document music, too, I suppose I should say that.
Last question for you all. This film that we just saw, it deals with the New Orleans music community and the way that it changed after Katrina. For those who don't know the scene that well, what would you all want people to know about it now and how they can get involved with it?
Well, it took me, we left the day before Katrina, whatever the day that was, and I didn't get back till November the 20th, I think it was. And so we were away for a long time, but we couldn't come back because a third of the house was blown down, you know. But how you can get involved now. Certainly the Musicians Clinic is a worthwhile donation because it really helps musicians, old, young, black, white, you know what I mean? They don't discriminate between anything. If you need help, you go there, you know, and they help you, you know.
Musicians Clinic, like I said in the theater earlier, it helps with health issues, but it also helps pay for gigs that musicians do. That some of the clubs, right after Katrina, some of the clubs were closed, and a few, as they started to reopen, some of them just didn't have a good cash flow because our population in the city had dropped. A lot of people weren't back yet for a lot of reasons. There was just so much money going into restoration and repair and rebuild that there wasn't a lot of free money to spend on businesses, and so it started slow, but now there's some new club openings, and I guess with that come new opportunities to play. So the music scene is very vibrant in New Orleans. All genres, covers a lot of ground with what we have, but I think it's doing well. I think, yeah, there's always room for improvement, but yeah, and like he said, the Musicians Clinic is still viable, thank God. It's helping a lot of musicians. Musicians don't come with an insurance policy. You know, if you get a job with, say, you know, the federal government, or if you're a teacher with the public schools, you get some type of health insurance. Sometimes it's optional, but it's they might help you subsidize the payments. You know, there's plans that you can buy into, and so you get good health insurance. Musicians don't have that, so it's straight out of pocket, which individually is very expensive, and most musicians can't afford it. They just can't, and so unless they're completely dependent on something like Medicaid, they're not going to get any kind of health care. And so what happens, it's a vicious cycle because they don't have insurance and they can't afford the health care. They don't go to the doctor unless it's an emergency. Sometimes that's too late. You know, they should do more preventative care. And they're very big on preventative care, too. So I want to thank Renee Edwards for creating this film and directing this film. I mean, she's the woman behind the whole project. So thank you, Renee.
Yeah.
For bringing this to life.
New Orleans has come back, isn't it, back to normal now. Perhaps better than it was, I don't know. But, they had the Great Fire in London and the plague in London still there.
It's quite the historical reference going back a few hundred years.
Well, yeah. But, human beings have got a way of, you know. And, the funny thing with me that people say, how you live in New Orleans with all them hurricanes? Man, hurricanes, I was born in the London Blitz. What the devil do I care about a hurricane? A bomb's dropping on you every night, you know. I've been for the first few years of my life. So, New Orleans is back to normal now, wouldn't you say?
Almost.
Yeah.
It's still a work in progress, let's say that.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining us. People want to learn more about what you all do personally. Where could they go to find out more?
WWOZ 90.7. I'm on every Thursday morning, 9 to 11 a.m. New Orleans time.
And can people get it online if they're not?
We stream worldwide, so it's wwoz.org. And we stream, if you have a computer, you can pick us up. We also wrote a two-week archive, so 2 weeks after every show, you can look up the date, the time. Go to my show, Traditional Jazz with Sally Young, and you can pick it up for 2 weeks.
Great. That's fantastic. And Barry?
We did her radio show. We had a letter from a friend of mine, or email, from, where was he? Someplace in, no, Germany, the first one. Yeah, well, it was loads. But I just had one. I read it to her in the car today. A man from Edinburgh, Scotland. Imagine that. Edinburgh, Scotland, listening to her radio show.
The power of radio and film. Up next is Andrew Vogel. He's the operations director for Louisiana International Film Festival. He's also an actor who's acted alongside of Robert Redford, and he has a couple of projects in development that you'll hear about here. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Nick. Thanks for having me on.
Give us a quick sense of what your responsibilities involve.
Sure. Well, I do a lot for the festival. I've kind of become Swiss Army man for him. I do a little bit of everything, and, you know, I do the email blast that you see, I do back-end stuff with membership, I do customer service, and right now what I'm doing is a lot of, I do print traffic for the festival, which means I'm responsible for making sure I get the films from the distributors, and then make sure they get sent back to the distributors, so that's a big part of what I'm doing now.
You left off one important job. Fashion escort extraordinaire.
Oh, see, yeah, a little bit of everything. See, just now I got to escort these fashion models down the staircase for our Dan Ireland New Voices, New Visions Awards presentation. So that was a job I didn't know I would have until about 30 seconds before I was doing it. So that was fun.
Yeah, having to escort all those beautiful ladies down the steps, arduous task. So it's one of those things you got to take your hits for when you're on the job. It's understandable, right?
Oh, yeah. It was absolutely miserable. I, when you have to escort pretty girls around, it's just, these are the times that try men's souls.
The unglamorous side of the movie industry. But thank you for doing that as a public service to everyone. So tell us more about the film prints, though. I imagine there are certain things you're checking to make sure this is there or it's not. What should filmmakers know about submitting their prints to the film festival?
What we need basically is DCP and Blu-ray, and we need a hard copy of that. But that's one thing that does happen a lot, especially for short films. People misread that or don't read that and end up trying to send us links, and we actually need a hard copy, DCP hard drive, and two Blu-ray backups, preferably, and that makes everything run smoothly and makes our techs up in the booth jobs a lot easier.
All right, so tell us more about some of the highlights this year that stuck out for you.
Well, obviously today was a big highlight. This was a lot of fun. Renee Zellweger came out and helped present the award for Dan Ireland. Dan Ireland was our artistic director, who unfortunately passed away opening night of the festival last year. And so this was our way of commemorating his legacy. And Renee was a good friend of Dan's. It was nice that she came out to show her support. So that was definitely a highlight. But it's been a good 4 days. It's been really good. I think aesthetically, you know, our presence has been the best year yet. You know, we have a great presence in the Great Hall this year. We got these two giant boots 3D printed by Lamar, which are pretty awesome and just really stand out. And got a great filmmakers lounge and have had some great parties, live music every night, aerialist performances. We also had a tour of Celtic Studios, and Dwight Henry came, you know, Dwight of Beasts of the Sun Wild, and Joey Tafuro, who's a friend of mine and produced Kidnapped and gearing up for his next film now. He came out and spoke, and we had Jerry Leggio, who kind of like helped start the tax credits, the father of our film industry, some people might say. He came out and spoke, so, and we had a brunch and everything. So been a lot of highlights.
All right, so speaking of acting, you're also an actor and a producer out in California. What kinds of things have you learned from the festival that you've been able to apply to your efforts in the industry?
The festival has not only taught me a lot, but it's given me a foundation. You know, when you're trying to get going as a producer, it's rather than saying, hey, I'm an actor, it's much better to say, hey, I work for a film festival out in Louisiana and been doing it for 5 years. Here's what
That's interesting. Have you found that to open more doors when you say, hey, I'm with this and can we talk, as opposed to just, hey, I'm an actor?
Absolutely, absolutely. Especially out in Los Angeles, you hear I'm an actor so often that people kind of tune it out. So people respect you more if you have something else you're involved in and something else you're a part of and have another skill set other than acting, even though that's a great skill set. This festival, I mean, I've learned so much from Chesley, who's become a mentor and a friend. And she's taught me how to craft emails and stuff, which I've realized to be monumentally important.
How do you craft emails for maximum impact?
I'd have to sit down with you on an email to look at one. But it's about a balance of professionalism and directness while still having pleasantries and while still being casual, while still being brief and to the point. You know, you don't want to overdo it. So there's a lot of little factors, little tricks.
Have you been sending some of the fundraising questions for the festival? And if so, has that improved your ability to raise funds for your films?
I've worked with Chesley a lot and helped her on the fundraising aspect, and learning from her and learning to craft those emails and learning how she does it has 100% helped me to craft emails to potential investors that I'm courting for my projects. I learned to be very grammatically correct while still having a casual air in some cases, you know, because you don't want to come across as over professional or
like two or three exclamation marks.
No. Yeah. I've learned one exclamation mark in email generally does the trick.
Do you have a guideline about emoticons, little smileys?
There's no emoticons in my emails.
Yeah, that's probably for the best. You don't want to be like too cash.
Hey, bro. What's up? Can you slip me an easy 10 grand or whatever?
Smiley face, winky face. Yeah, that.
GIFs, animated GIFs.
Yeah, exactly. None of that, you know.
So I think the takeaway, if you're trying to raise money, do not use animated GIFs, ideally, unless absolutely necessary, and then case-by-case basis is what I'm hearing, right?
Yeah, that you hit the nail on the head, Nick. Thank you. Thank you for putting that all into a nice, pretty box for the audience to take it away. And
yeah, I try. It's a little way that I can give back to our listeners. Thank you, listeners. On a more serious note, Louisiana International Film Festival also does a special event at Sundance each year. So tell us a little bit about that and how being involved has helped you as a filmmaker.
Oh, yeah, it's helped me immensely. I mean, a lot of people don't even know how we do this massive blowout party at Sundance every year. It's become like every year at Sundance, it's the talk of the town, and people, you know, say it's their favorite party at Sundance. And we have people, aerialists, people hanging from the ceiling and drinks, and we have the biggest venue, Park City Live. But anyway, I was the VIP host this year, which was, you know, I ended up meeting so many great people in the industry and people that I'm still one of which is my business partner now, and people that I have followed up with and still connected to in Los Angeles, and has greatly helped me to form my network and meet the right people. So yeah.
Do you have any projects that you want to tell us about?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I moved out to Los Angeles for acting and quickly found that I had a network for producing, and my goal out in Los Angeles has become to become an asset on as many projects as possible. And because of that, I've been fortunate to get involved in a lot of different projects. I just shot a pilot presentation that we're going to be pitching some different networks that I produced and acted in and wrote, and got this great Russian director working on that. I also have two films I'm helping out on. One of the films actually is called Gina 6, which I think is a really important film. It's about the racial injustices in Gina, Louisiana in 2006. It surrounds this kid, Michael Bell, who was wrongly accused and ended up being sentenced to life in prison, and ended up not having to serve that, but served a whole year. And this guy, Michael Bell, was actually at the festival yesterday, and I escorted him around and snuck him into the booth and showed him how the projectors work, and got him into the Ryan Francis story. And so we had a good little time. So I'm working on that film. That's with the producer, Dawn Krantz, who produced Man Down. And she's become a sort of a mentor out in Los Angeles. And got another one that I can't say too much about, but it's a supernatural thriller that is supposed to be shooting in Jordan in January that I helped produce, and I'll actually be playing one of the lead roles. So finally starting to see the fruits of my labor and the fruits of trying to utilize this network in the best way I can. And yeah, so got a lot happening and really looking forward to how this year unfolds.
Cool. Congratulations for staying so busy. Last question for you. You got to spend some time with Dan Ireland. And last year, as you mentioned, he died during the festival. It's been about a year since he passed. Do you have any memories of Dan that you want to share with us?
Man, I like Dan a lot. Dan was a mentor of mine and a good friend and extremely warm and one of those guys that just always made you laugh and always made you feel immediately comfortable.
All right, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Nick.
I want to take a break from our Lyft 2017 coverage and tell you a little bit more about some of the things I do when I'm not working on this podcast. I also do various film and video projects. In fact, Andrew was in a short film of mine I directed called Trent's War. I met Andrew through the film festival, as it happened. Someone I had met a couple years ago recommended him as an actor, and we got to know each other from there. Now, Trent's War was a film that we made about a soldier battling post-traumatic stress. We did the best we could with it at the time, but the film is not quite there yet. We've been talking about possibly expanding the story or doing a longer take on it, but that's going to take some time and resources. So we've been talking about releasing our short film in a limited way in June to coincide with PTSD Awareness Month. While I don't consider our short to be a perfect short film, I'm proud of the work that some of the people like Andrew did in it, and we want to share it with you and get your feedback. Just hear what you think, and that will help us figure out if it makes sense at some point to tell the more extended version of that film. So if that's of interest to you, let me know. Shoot me an email, podcast@ncivitis.com, and I'll make sure that you stay up to date about if and when that happens. Once again, podcast@ncivitis.com. All right, now let's get back to our coverage of LIFT 2017. The next interview is with Alexander Jeffrey. He's the director of the LA Film Prize winning short, The Bespoke Tailoring of Mr. Bellamy. Alexander also worked on three projects that screened at LIFT this year, including Last Light, which went on to win Best Louisiana Short Film of LIFT 2017.
Hello.
Hey, Nick, how are you?
I understand you have a couple projects, three projects here at the festival this year.
I did, yeah. So as part of the top five showcase from the Louisiana Film Prize, my short film Memoir screened. And then in the Louisiana live action shorts, I worked on both The Verses and Last Light.
Tell us a little bit about the projects, more specifically Last Light. Tell us a little bit more about that, and then a quick overview on some of the others as well.
Great. So Last Light, I was actually the writer on, and it's a mother-daughter reconciliation story that I had the pleasure of working on with Jency Griffin-Hogan and Sam Fisicaro. I came on board as the writer pretty late into the process, and I really, really enjoyed writing it, and I was on set as the first AD for it and just helping out however I could. It's a really fun film. It's dark and heavy in some places, but we tried to infuse as much lightness into it as we could. I'm really proud of Sam's performance in the film and Jency's directing and Joel's cinematography. I think it turned out great.
And that's when you got connected with through Jency?
I actually met Jency years and years and years ago at the first El Dorado Film Festival that I run. And our first project that we worked on together was called With My Soul, and that screened here at LIFT last year. That was kind of our first project that we worked on together, and since then we've done The Verses, which screened here at LIFT, and then Last Light. You know, sometimes filmmakers get that sort of, like, hypercritical cringe, like, don't want to watch, turn the head away, and I didn't feel that at all. I really enjoyed watching the movies with the audience here in Baton Rouge, and the reception was great. We had a great Q&A afterwards.
Of all those projects that you did, are there any big lessons or takeaways that you'd care to share with us?
Oh, man. I mean, they're all three are so different. The biggest lesson I learned from doing memoir was that the writing process is the free part of the filmmaking, right? So that's the part that you get to spend the most time and the least amount of dollars on, and take as much time with that part of the process as you can afford. As far as time goes, you know, obviously the shoot date has to come sometime and you have to make it, especially if you're making it for a competition like the Louisiana Film Prize. But I wish that we had had a few more months with the script on that one.
All right. So let's now talk about your experience here at the festival. I understand you got to see a couple of panels and maybe the occasional film or two.
Yeah, it's been really awesome. So the energy here at LIFT has been really high. Jency, who is like the filmmaker liaison, has done just an incredible job of making us feel welcome, and they have put on some incredible panels. I got to go to this distribution panel, and these two gentlemen, Robert Palma and Steven from Los Angeles, came and talked about their involvement in the industry and spoke specifically about, you know, how to sell your film, which to me is kind of always the, like, fairy dust moment in filmmaking. Like, oh, you know, you make these things and then...
And you can actually make money from this magical process or these magical people, right?
It's so weird. Yeah, it's like, it's the part that you don't really want to think about as the creative brain is, you know, working, but it's filmmaking is a business, and these guys did such a great job and were so generous about laying the process and sort of demystifying the process for us about the distribution and what kind of meetings you might have and what kind of questions the distributors might ask and what might they require you to have as far as acquisition materials go. So I learned, for instance, one thing that I learned and I'll share with your podcast is that Netflix is one of the only companies that absolutely requires filmmakers to have E&O insurance, which means errors and omissions. So if you do not have E&O insurance when you're going into the distribution process, you know, that's something that you're going to have to add to your budget after the fact. And if it's something you don't plan for, then you could get, you know, thrown with a $3,000, $5,000 charge later on in the post process that wouldn't be fun to know about. But knowing about it up front and being able to plan for that is really valuable. And Both Stephen and Robert were so generous with talking to me after the fact, after the panel, and answering further questions, and it's been a great time.
Have you seen any films here or entirely panels?
So I did. I saw the Louisiana live action short block and the top five showcase, the Louisiana Film Prize. And for the most part, I had seen most of the films in those blocks before. There were one or two new films that I saw that I really, really enjoyed. One of them was called Backtrack Vodka by a guy named Brandon Bruno. And it was about it was time travel via vodka shots. And I thought that was a really kind of clever, fun concept. They were able to do it, you know, super low budget, and it was creative.
What are you watching for as a director when you're watching other films? What do you take note of?
You know, I take note of creativity in terms of coverage, shot selection, movement. And when I say movement, I mean both of the camera and of the actors. How do they block a scene? And I'm looking at choices in music, choices in performance, casting, all those kind of things. You know, it sucks. I mean, a lot of people may think that's like a huge curse that I can't really watch a movie without, you know, turning my brain off. But it's something that I actually enjoy. I enjoy watching a movie from a critical standpoint and looking at all of these different elements and how they come together in the final piece.
Any specific examples of movement that stuck out for you?
One thing actually I noticed in watching Memorial Drive, which is a film by Austin Allward, a second time, was that he really did move the camera really well and creatively chose to overlay certain images at certain times. And I thought that was a very strong directing choice. You could see his hand in the process, which is pretty cool.
All right, last question for you. Any special memories that you have here at the festival or from prior years that you want to share with us?
Oh, man. It's all been such a blur, but it's been really fun.
You guys are all so beautiful in your own. Okay. Can you give us one in particular here?
One memory in particular from the festival is, you know, honestly, I've talked about it quite a bit already, but that distribution panel is something that is going to stay with me and stick with me for the next several years. I mean, I learned so much, and getting to talk to Stephen after the panel and, you know, have him say, you know, I'm a producer and a manager and I'd love to watch your films. Will you send me a couple links to your movies? That's so cool to get these opportunities to talk with people in the industry that are doing this professionally for a living and have them, you know, show interest that's genuine in the stuff that you're doing as well.
Alexander Jeffrey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We are here with Jason Allen, the production director of the Louisiana International Film Festival. Hey, Jason.
How's it going, Nick?
So in addition to helping with the festival, you're also a filmmaker. You worked extensively as a first AD. What are some lessons that you've learned being part of the filmmaking team?
Well, something we're really proud of at the Louisiana International Film Festival and mentorship program is the fact that we are nurturing the creative infrastructure of the state of Louisiana. So as a first assistant director, my number one goal is to nurture the atmosphere and the crew and the cast and the production for the movie and for the set. So I equate what we do here at the festival to making movies as a first assistant director by communicating and anticipating and following through with very ambitious and lofty goals. And in our fifth year of this film festival, we've set out to go big.
So tell us a little bit more about your experiences as a first AD. What does that look like for you?
I really love being a first assistant director. I've been doing it for about 14 years. And as a first assistant director, done 14 features to date. I mainly do narrative and low budget movies. Been a member of the Directors Guild of America for the past 5 years. And I take to heart bringing the crew together to achieve the director's vision. And I love teaching that. I love kind of being the mentor to that. So I commonly do that when I'm working on lower budget movies, independent movies, where we're teaching our interns, our production assistants, and indoctrinating them to the process and the system of how to make movies. I also do a lot of work with the American Film Institute and mentor their thesis films, their graduate thesis films. These are things that fuel me, that I'm this intricate part of not only the creative process, but the logistical process, working with the unit production manager on how to coordinate our schedule and our budget, how to, you know, coordinate our locations and our transportation and our logistics as to how we're going to accomplish the movie at hand. And very much working with the director and the cinematographer, you know, shot by shot, scene by scene, day by day, getting into how we're going to strategize and lay out this movie that we're making. I've been really fortunate to work with some great people, great filmmakers and professionals. They nurture my career as I have nurtured their career. This is a lateral success. And I feel really good about my trajectory for making movies in the future and continuing to nurture making movies here in Louisiana, making films in my home state of North Dakota, which I've been working on legislation for.
You're a busy man, Jason.
I was actually talking to Jay Darden about my legislation proposals in North Dakota. I thought that was pretty cool.
For both the film festival and a film shoot, the positions you're doing, logistics are key. So how do you plan for that in advance?
I would say the plan in advance starts today, which is the day after the film festival. We have to, from this point forward, start looking at the next year. We have to start looking about what we did really, really well this year and how we had great success in our theater attendance and in our events. More people came out than ever, and we sold out multiple screenings. We had an incredible turnout for mentorship program, and that's 3 full days of mentorship program. Looking at our success, looking at the way that our patrons and sponsors in this community really nurture us is how we look forward into the future and how we plan the next year's film festival. And it begins today. This year, I think with all the limitations we had, and this comes from state and economic and environmental disasters that took place over the course of the year.
We definitely like say the flooding of Louisiana and so on.
Yes, this was a serious detriment to the economy and to business and overall even a nonprofit organization in its 5th year. So we had our challenges just to meet an expectation and deliver on very little means. We're extremely thrilled that we were able to bring everyone together and have such a great time and a great turnout, but we're looking to take this to the next level.
You mentioned the flood, and it felt like you all addressed that even in the programming and some of the events you all did, acknowledging the people who helped the Cajun Navy and so on.
We had a special presentation at 3:00 on Saturday, that was on the 22nd, that honored the heroes of the Great Flood, relief workers that went above and beyond, and we featured a documentary called When the River Rises, and this was very well received, sold out 2 houses, and we really wanted to give it up and celebrate the heroism of the relief workers. So.
What are some of the other highlights of the festival that you want to accentuate for people?
Showcasing some of the great films that came out of Louisiana this year, like the Ryan Francis story. This is sold out 3 screens and had really a box office record for us and goes on to win the best documentary of Louisiana, best Louisiana documentary.
So to clarify, the record for this year or of all time?
All time. We've never sold out 3 houses with the movie, but this particular movie about a local hero, basketball hero, that was a victim to gun violence, resonated with this community, and they came out for it. They came out to support it and voted unanimously that this was a great film to feature. So it won our best Louisiana documentary. You have a film like The Red Pill, which has been gaining a lot of controversy in Australia, UK, and all parts of Europe. It highlights the men's rights movement. This is a documentary directed by Cassie J and produced by her and her mother, Nina J. They came to our film festival and it was very well received and also received the Audience Award for Best Documentary. We're very, very proud of our jury award that we gave away this year. This was our very first jury prize to honor Dan Ireland. This went to Kills on Wheels. In honor of Dan Ireland, this New Vision, New Voices Award highlights, celebrates an up-and-coming filmmaker. So Kills on Wheels takes that award as well as the Audience Award for Best Feature Film at our festival this year. And then there were a number of amazing shorts film programs. We sold out two Louisiana short film programs, and that's something we're really proud of. I mean, very high caliber of films coming out of the state, and we're really proud to highlight them, as well as feature some amazing films from around the world. World-class, award-winning, acclaimed feature films and documentaries. Those are the big highlights as far as that. We had an amazing closing night. We were honoring Dan Ireland with the presentation of the first award, and we were graced with the presence of Ms. Renee Zellweger, who was a close friend of Dan's and collaborator with him in her early career. She's a sweetheart, and she completely put her whole heart into being here in Baton Rouge with us to celebrate Dan, and she was with us. It was a wonderful celebration on the red carpet, and we had a fashion show. We always go all out, and then we had our closing night gala and award ceremony. Definitely big highlights for us, Nick. Yeah,
so much goes into making a film festival happen. All kinds of things you're facing throughout the festival and in preparation. Do you want to give us a sense of any challenge you face and how you overcame it?
The challenges we face, I would compare to the adversity that might be in a startup company. I compare that to how do we build on a brand? How do we, you know, basically start a social movement? Yeah, and now that we're at a point with this film festival where we're getting so much of this amazing community behind us, we need to expand out. The challenge of bringing in national sponsors, the challenges of bringing in a level of financing that's going to sustain this film festival, I think that's the greatest challenge. And I really look up to everyone that has so graciously supported this, and we're going to keep it going. But I'm looking for us to take this to the next level. I know Chesley Himesfield, the executive director, is looking to take this to the next level. We're reaching out and want to utilize our resources in this community to really embrace the future of this film festival. That's our greatest challenge, building infrastructure. Having a year-long program that not only includes our film society where you have monthly screenings, but also includes mentorship workshops and panels, discussions with special guests and filmmakers that we can bring in annually. Having a space we can work from, I think this is going to be crucial. I'd love to be at Perkins Row. I've already talked to the property manager.
Like a permanent space, you mean?
I want a permanent space at Perkins Row. But that's just from my standpoint. We of course, would like to continue our amazing partnership with Perkins Row, and their management has been phenomenal this year. I really think that's where we've been elevated, Nick. Amidst every single challenge we faced, we rose to the occasion. We really did. Every single person that needed to step up, they really did. And I think it comes from this community spirit that rallies around this film festival.
Jason, one of the things that's noteworthy about you is how energetic and upbeat you are, even in the midst of a film festival. It seems like you bring that to your films as well, from what I can tell. How do you maintain that in the midst of the chaos?
I do pride myself on keeping a positive attitude and a good spirit. It really stems from my belief in people. Along with our amazing sponsors, we couldn't do this without ambassadors. And I don't just mean volunteers. I mean the people that give of their time but actually represent this film festival. They represent this community, and they connect us to this film festival. So what I set out to do in managing chaos is empower my team and let them know that everything they're doing is for a worthy cause and bring out the best in them, hopefully. I know that it sometimes comes with maybe a curtness or a direct sense of how we get it done in the most efficient and effective way. But my goal is for everyone to feel really empowered by the work we're doing, and that they don't see it as just tasks, and that they see it as a greater good. And I bring that to a movie set as well. When we're on low budget independent film that requires us to step up to that and be creative and manage our chaos, So I think when you can bring that about and be the team cheerleader, keep everybody on track and essentially have the structure in the organization to guide, considering what I do, I'm managing the logistics and operations of the theater and the screenings, the mentorship and all of the workshops and panel discussions, as well as the events. Now, I'm the least hands-on with the events because Miss Heather Day and the Red Cake Event Company is the most, she's the most amazing asset we have because she brings the party. She has a spirit that invokes celebration, and that is why she's been so near and dear to us. We could not do this without her. The mentorship, I'm a little more hands-on in the respect to wanting to make sure that this is something we're passionate about, something we want to make sure goes really well and reaches the community. So we want to fuel it with amazing filmmakers and special guests. So I'm hands-on in facilitating to that and that technology a little bit. But I'm the most hands-on in the theater and the theater management and the screenings and making sure that the 70-plus movies get on the screen in the right way. They're announced, they're on time, they're on schedule. It's a moving machine. We're counting ballots. That's legitimate. That's in time and in process, on schedule. I'm keeping all those things in line with the big picture in mind that I want you, the audience member, the attendant of the Louisiana International Film Festival, to have the greatest time you've ever had and to do this exponentially year after year. I just really had the most amazing time this year. It was the hardest. It was one of the hardest years we've had, but it was one of the most fulfilling, and I think it's because we got to honor Dan Ireland. It's because we really made a point and are going to continue to make a point to celebrate Dan Ireland's life and work and what he meant to us. Dan Ireland is our past artistic director. He passed away this time last year, right as we opened the film festival. He meant so much to what we do, and we will forever miss him. He's our friend and our mentor. So we want to honor him with this jury award, the Dan Ireland New Visions, New Voices Award, and celebrate him every year. He directed a film back in 1996 called The Whole Wide World, starring Renee Zellweger and Vincent D'Onofrio. This was when Renee was very early in her career and was practically unknown before she landed the role in Jerry Maguire, which made her an international celebrity superstar.
So in conclusion, do you have any memories of Dan that you want to share with us, Jason?
My fondest memories of Dan have to be from the very beginning. When we were in the first year of this film festival, I've never run or organized anything like this ever before, but I was confident that with Dan's guidance and with Jeff Dowd's tenacity and with Chesley Himesfield's gumption, we were going to get it done. And I bring something to this amazing team. And Dan identified that in me. He saw something in me, and I will forever remember just that thing that he sees in us, that thing he sees in good people that he connected with. That's what made Dan special. That's what he leaves us with. That's what is going to continue to resonate and fuel this film festival. And that first year, I got to tell you, and just kind of figuring things out with Dan and never letting up and never having our standards falter. Dan always held us to that. So we're gonna honor him every year.
All right. Well, Jason, thank you for sharing that. And thank you for another memorable Louisiana International Film Festival.
I want to thank you, Nick. You're not only a podcaster or a Baton Rouge community member, but you are a super ambassador of the film festival. And we appreciate your presence and what you bring. And I want to continue to see our partnership elevated year by year as well.
All right. Well, here's to ongoing collaborations. Thanks a lot, Jason. Appreciate it.
We are here with Chesley, the executive director of the Louisiana International Film Festival. Hello, Chesley.
Hello, Nick.
You've had a little bit of time to unwind since the festival ended, and a lot goes into making a festival happen. Looking back, what are some things in the festival experience that make you think this is why we do it?
Well, I would say that the culmination of a lot of hard work and thought and planning and strategy and relationship building really comes down to our audience and the filmmakers who attend. So, you know, a lot of this goes on behind the scenes. And really the gratification you get is when people are able to come out and enjoy watching the movies, but also they're able to meet one another. And this year we had over 100 filmmakers who came from around the country. And it was really, I think, a step up for us in terms of the organic networking that was taking place. And for me, coming from a producer and writer background, it's really gratifying to see that happening at our festival in an organic way, which is really what you want a festival to evolve into. So, and also, of course, getting to see our audiences enjoy the movies.
Did you get the chance to catch up with anyone, or it was just about staying on top of the storm that is the film festival?
Actually, a lot of my work happens way before the festival, commences. So usually my work is completely done. It's very similar to whenever I've produced a movie before or a project. I usually finish my work before the project begins. And then what you're doing is you're just having an exchange of ideas and building relationships and camaraderie that takes place during an event, whether it's a movie or a film festival. It's really the same premise for me. So a lot of it was catching up with old friends, making new friends, and introducing people to one another who I think would benefit greatly from knowing each other.
Any memorable films or events from the festival that stick out for you?
Sure. I think that our opening night with Patty Cakes, which was produced by the New Orleans-based company called Department of Motion Pictures. It's the same team that brought you Beasts of the Southern Wild. I think it was very exciting to see them come to the festival and have it as our opening night. And now it's going to be at the closing night for Director's Fortnight at Cannes Film Festival coming up later this month. So I think it was really inspiring that we were able to host that for a Louisiana audience before it goes overseas.
There was also Unrest, one of the films that you sponsored.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct.
Was that something that you really connected with?
Absolutely. I suffer from the same illness, fibromyalgia or myoencephalitis or any of the other names that it can be called. And
it's sometimes called chronic fatigue syndrome, right?
Right. It has so many different names. And of course, none of them are really great. Myoencephalitis is hard to say. Fibromyalgia sounds fake. Chronic fatigue sounds made up. So when you really put it together, it's like, it's tough. I mean, tuberculosis sounds real and threatening. Really, it's a name game. And I think that a lot of the frustration that surrounds the illness that's depicted in Unrest is the lack of understanding and the therefore lack of compassion from the medical community and family, friends, colleagues. And really, an illness, strangely, always begins with the name. So I think that Unrest was originally titled Canary in a Coal Mine, and vis-a-vis the name difficulty, they changed it to Unrest, which typifies a part of the symptoms of the illness being that you're never fully rested. That's only one component to it, but I think Unrest also symbolizes, the idea of our society not really being able to accept an illness that especially, unfortunately, afflicts mainly women.
It sounds like that condition is something that you also wrestle with. I didn't realize that about you. Would you say the film helps others who don't face that condition get a better understanding of what it involves?
I think the only way to fully understand that illness, fibromyalgia, myoencephalitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, whatever you want to call it, is to be in the body of the person who suffers from it. I think it's acutely impossible to understand it without living in that body yourself. There are no words that you could use to describe it. There are no words in the English language or any other language. But I think that what you have to do when you look at a film is have an open mind. And I think that having an open mind can lead to compassion, and compassion can lead to awareness, and awareness can lead to discovery and treatment, or potential cure. And so I think having a film like this at least opens the door to understanding, although it may not complete it full circle.
That was one of the films at your festival, along with some others that screened at Sundance. Is that how you saw it, or did you catch it elsewhere?
Actually, I'd been communicating with the director ever since she started the premise for the movie. And I watched it then go to the Sundance Lab, which was very exciting, which is an incredible part of their institute. And then now they've actually developed another component to Sundance where they're assisting filmmakers with their distribution efforts. So now it's a part of a campaign to get the film distributed. And, you know, it has a wonderful team behind it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, several of our programmers had seen it at Sundance, but I watched it by a screener that was sent to me. I actually have only gone halfway through the film because for me, it's very personal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty neat, though, that you got to follow the film and then eventually bring it to your festival and help sponsor it.
Oh, absolutely. I was very proud to do so. And I hope that the director, Jennifer Brea, not only continues to make movies, but that she also gets better.
Speaking of Sundance, you all have that connection to the festival. Once again, this year, you all did a special event at Sundance, the Bayou Burlesque this year, and you brought a number of your team, your creative support staff, to do that event. So I was wondering if you would elaborate on some of the ways that you all are trying to strengthen that Sundance connection and why that's important.
Well, to start off, Sundance really was one of the cornerstones of the American independent cinema movement in this country. And of course, Seattle International Film Festival, which our former artistic director, Dan Ireland, founded, was even before Sundance took place. And so for us to be in the grassroots of it and there with the people who've had the longevity is very important. Not only just for us to be able to learn, but for us to be able to grow those relationships side by side, those veterans in the industry. Every year we have a theme. So we've been doing it now for 5 years. We've had Mardi Gras, we've had Midnight Masquerade, we've had Voodoo Love, Bayou Burlesque, all kinds of really catchy names that reflect and typify the Louisiana culture. And so for us, you know, it's not only an opportunity to be able to stand again side by side with people who founded the movement that we're now taking part in, but also for us to be able to represent the Louisiana culture in terms of the talent that's coming up. So Heather Day is a great example. She runs Red Cake Event Planning, and she planned that event masterfully. And she had Kiana Linnell, who's an amazing singer, and her group come up. We had our chefs come, Sean Rivera. We've had just so many people also with, he came the year before, and then this year we had and Sacolite Restaurant in New Orleans with Samantha and Cody Carroll. We've had all kinds of people come out. We also had Acro Rouge, and they did an incredible performance, of course, on the stage, and that I was not a part of. And so
were
for
you
us,
hoping to get in on that action?
You know, honestly, it's better that I leave it to the professionals. And so this year we had a completely packed venue. It takes place at Park City Live, which is the largest musical venue at Park City in Sundance. And it was completely packed. It's a 700-person venue. And so for us now, we've been able to build this cachet of kind of a cultural notoriety that we're able to bring to people in the industry, whether, again, it's music or film or dance or, you know, anything like that, entertainment, technology, we're able to bring people from the state out there and have an opportunity to be on that platform. So we're proud to continue that tradition. And then, of course, we bring people who we meet there to come to our festival in Louisiana and continue the conversation. It's really a part of our long-term relationship building that we do.
Your opening night film was Patty Cakes, which premiered at Sundance. The film that closed it out for you all was The Hero, which also premiered at Sundance. Are you all trying to further the connection through the programming, or it just happens to be that Sundance has really great films that premiere there?
Sundance premieres a lot of great films. We also have had films that overlap before with Tribeca, with other festivals, and really there is a festival circuit where a lot of the programmers speak to one another. And of course, there's a great notoriety in being able to be the world premiere, and of course, then the U.S. premiere, or even a Louisiana premiere. So a lot of times we do consider that as a factor before we screen films, but we also have relationships as well with the distributors. And that one is Fox Searchlight. And Fox Searchlight to me is really one of the most, you know, pinnacle distribution companies you could be with. And they won the bidding war to be able to represent Patty Cakes. So we were happy to have it.
Right. So let's turn the focus back to your festival. Are there any premieres you're eager to discuss with us?
For me, it's always an honor to be able to showcase films that are made by up-and-coming filmmakers and also films that are made by Louisiana filmmakers. So we did have Taronda Bazile this year, who directed her first film called The Ryan Francis Story. And it was exciting for us to be able to show that. And we ended up selling out 3 theaters. And I'm quite sure we could have sold out 3 more theaters with that film, of course, because it has a local impact. And it's about, you know, a local man. So to me, that's always very gratifying to be able to tell those personal stories. And we also were able to do the world premiere as well for When the Rivers Rise by Paul Catalanato. And that was very exciting to have the Springfield Fire Department and other groups attend that world premiere as well.
All right. Let's talk about Renee Zellweger. She made quite an impression. She came to be there for the special screening of Dan's film, The Whole Wide World, which apparently is the film that put her on the map, and deservedly so. She's quite good in it. But she was also part of your award ceremony in honor of Dan. So what goes into bringing a celebrity like Renee Zellweger to your festival?
With Renee, she's just an exceptional person. I mean, she's really, truly a wonderful person. And whether she's a prominent actress or not, Renee exceeds far beyond my expectations in terms of what anyone would be able to give to the film festival and to helping us start the Dan Ireland Award. And I cannot say enough good things about her. She took her own volition to be able to not only come to this festival, but to become a sponsor in what we were doing. So she was so independent and absolutely wonderful and extremely gracious with her time. And she just has exceeded all of our expectations. And so really, we want to just be able to respect her time as we do with any of our filmmakers and special guests, and be sure that when they're there, they're being greeted by people who would like to say thank you.
It sounds like she got involved early on. Was this tied to Dan's passing last year?
Yeah, I was able to meet a lot of Dan's friends who I had heard so much about, and vice versa, they had heard so much about us, but we'd never actually had the opportunity to meet. And a film festival, like, you know, we discussed earlier in our conversation, is a great opportunity to be able to meet people or catch up with people. And so, you know, basically last April, after Dan passed away, a lot of his friends planned a memorial for him that took place in May. And it was just the most incredible, inspiring thing that I've ever been to in my life. It was at one of the Lemley Theaters in Los Angeles, and it was completely packed at 9 in the morning with hundreds of people. And all of them, a lot of them, got up and said, you know, very moving words about their time with Dan. And Renee was one of those people, and we connected at that event and, you know, at Dan's memorial, and stayed in touch. And she was just incredibly generous to offer her time and her, you know, financial contribution to the Dan Ireland Award too. And so she's been one of his friends, and there are a number of them who've just stood out and really been very vocal about continuing Dan's legacy. And I think that's all that any of us can really hope for when you die one day, is to have your friends and your family continue all the things that you helped to start and envision. And I'm just really proud of her, and also of Dan's sister, Judy, and their whole family, and all of Dan's friends. We had a lot of people who drove up from different places or flew in to be a part of it. And one of our jury members on the Dan Ireland Award, Michael Scott Myers, who is the screenwriter for Whole Wide World, hadn't seen each other for 20 years. So it was an opportunity for them to reconnect, as well as a lot of other people.
Yeah. I'm glad you were able to bring her in. It felt like it was a cohesive part of the whole festival experience, with Dan's shadow hanging over everything like it did.
Thank you. Well, him and Miss Shelley Winters, his beloved kitty cat, were on our program this year. And, you know, I want to ensure that everything we do with Dan is with the utmost integrity, but also with a little hint of comedy, because I think he would appreciate it.
It seems like it was in keeping with Dan.
Right.
Or at least the little that I know of him. We'll come back to him in a moment, but I want to talk a little bit more about bringing a celebrity to an event. I imagine that some of the people listening would be interested in that possibility of saying, well, if possible, my event could benefit from bringing a high-profile person. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the practical side. You're providing security to make sure they're not mobbed. You're possibly going through their publicity person or through some other contact? And what other practical suggestions do you have about doing that?
We've had all kinds of people who've been able to grace the festival over the years. And really, there is no standard rule. Some of them you can just talk to directly. Some of them you're able to talk to their publicist, or to a lot of them have assistants who you can speak with. But really, all of those things evolve out of a personal relationship that we have. To me, that's just very important. And it's really the cornerstone of everything we do, is to be very, very genuine in our outreach and to make sure that people feel, you know, appreciated. And so whether that's through them directly or through an assistant or through a publicist or through a distributor or through the distributor's PR firm, there are a lot of different ways to approach people. But whenever you do, just always be sure that you're completely genuine in your intention and that you have a benefit for that person as well to be involved.
With Renee in particular, the festival is showing a film she starred in with a director that the festival's honoring. So there's that tie-in.
Absolutely. And that's the great thing about a film festival, is that we are now in the position to assist with grassroots community outreach and building, marketing, publicity, you know, advertising, getting the word out, putting people on a platform so they're able to, you know, tell their ideas and their inspiration, and so that they're then able to influence other people in a very positive and meaningful way. So really the heart of a film festival is being able to have benefit for everyone. And so it makes it a very easy scenario for us to reach out and connect and build these relationships. My advice would be to anyone, whatever you're doing, always engage the person on their passions and always be very genuine in your commitment to them and to your own mission and your own vision.
Right. So we touched on this a little bit, but let's go over what's involved. There's usually someone assigned to picking up the high-profile person, possibly a day of lodging, possibly a fee involved to bring that person. There's also a security detail to keep them safe. Anything else?
Right. I totally see where you're coming from, because that would make the most sense. But, you know, people always surprise me. And a lot of the people who come in of their own volition. We're not instructed to pay for anything, you know, which is absolutely incredible. And that, again, that comes back to the idea of being genuine and pursuing the same mutual passion and interest. We do provide some hotel and transportation and airfare for people, but that also includes directors who are completely unknown or actors who are unknown, because we see them as, you know, up and coming. So we make the same kind of investment and commitment to the people who are unknown just as much as the people who are known. And we do have security as well, but that security is provided throughout our entire event. And they just have a different strategy when we have someone who's notable coming. But we also had the mayor attend. We've had, you know, Jay Darden attend. We had several other people who do require security as well. And so that is a part of their overall strategy.
Okay. So it sounds like it might actually be accessible for someone or an organization to bring in a high-profile person.
Right.
If they find a way to connect with that person's passions.
Always pursue the passion. You know, passion and, you know, having a very, again, genuine belief and intent and interest that is mutually shared is critical for bringing in people, whether they're celebrities, whether they're politicians, whether they're, you know, it's the grandmother down the street. Everyone shares a passion. And so I think it's really important, whether you're, you know, running a film festival or whether you're running any nonprofit or you have an idea. Always, if you're passionate and you're confident and, you know, you have a very good intent, people will come and be a part of what you're doing. You know, I think that people want that kind of leadership and opportunity to be able to be a part of something bigger than them and to be able to collaborate. I mean, we're social creatures. And at the end of the day, people do want to join up together and be a team. And I've always worked that way. And I think that you want to find people who work in a similar fashion. And, you know, not every notable person is going to come to your event, but you can certainly find that one person who will.
That's great advice. Thank you for sharing that.
Absolutely.
All right. So now let's talk a little bit more about Dan Ireland. It seems like he was a good friend of yours, and he significantly impacted the shape of the festival. I was wondering if you could comment on the influence he's had on you as a person and on the way the festival has developed.
Well, I think really there's no accurate way to determine how much a person has influenced you, but I can certainly say that Dan Ireland has influenced me more than almost anyone else that I've known in my life professionally. And as a friend, he really did open up my world to so much. I mean, he was just a very unique and special person and just completely full of life. And he was very much our mentor, really. And even though sometimes in your life you end up hiring people to work with, that doesn't mean you can't hire your mentor. That's what Dan was to us. He was really the mentor for the festival, but I think for all of us individually as well. I mean, if you speak with a lot of the people who came to the festival or work with us every year, the thing they mention is that Dan was their mentor. And every year I find out more and more people who he influenced. And it's just this growing web of people. And we all share that one thing in common, which is our relationship with him. And, you know, that's something we just want to continue to build and reflect upon, because as the years go on, I feel like his legacy will become even more bold than it is today.
Yeah, it seems like the festival is going to work hard to ensure that happens.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think all of us individually as well, we're looking at forming a Dan Ireland legacy committee, which would involve his friends from around the country and around the world who would take part in, you know, keeping him alive. And I think that's the best we can do for, you know, or at least the minimum we can do for someone who influenced us on, you know, not only professionally, but also personally as a friend. You know, when you think about it, you spend so much time with the people you work with, you know, and Dan was there with us from the very beginning. I actually met him. I went to the dude from the Big Lebowski, Jeff Dowd's house in Venice Beach. And Jeff, I knew through a project I was working on in California. And he introduced me to Dan, and it kind of went from there, and they were co-artistic directors the first year. Then Dan became our artistic director, and we shared a lot together. I mean, that's a lot of time to spend with someone, you know, 4 years back to back, or even more than that, and going through the hard times, going through the good times. And it's really almost like being married. You know, yeah. When you work with people, you spend a lot of time with them. I really value people who are there from the beginning or people who are there through hard times, because you can share the good times too.
All right. Last question for you here. Do you have a special memory of Dan you want to share with us to close this out?
Well, I think just his laugh. I mean, really, it's such a funny thing to say about a person, but everyone, even during his memorial, would get up and try and imitate his laugh.
Can you do a pretty good imitation?
Okay, let me try. Hold on. I'm not an actor. You have to remember.
All right.
But the thing is, it would always be, he would say it after something very poignant, like, oh, you know, like one of his friends said, he met him, he was in the gym, and he was banging his head against the locker, Dan's friend, not Dan. And Dan walked in and said, oh, I had a day like that. So he would always kind of say something to you that would normally be an insult, but then he would laugh.
Then you get the laugh. Hilarious. That's a great way to follow that line.
That's just, I think that's the thing that everyone remembers about him, is what he would say to you and then laugh, and it would make you laugh, and it would be completely 100% accurate, so you couldn't help but laugh.
Okay, great. Well, Chesley, thank you for sharing that with us, and I look forward to seeing what you all do in the years to come.
Well, thank you, Nick, and we look forward to seeing the same with you.
All right.
All right, I'll talk to you soon.
So those are my interviews from LIFF 2017. Now I want to share some related thoughts. So first I'll give you some broad observations about the discussions and the festival experience. And then I'll talk about some of the films I got to see and my takeaways from those. And then for those of you who want to stick around all the way through, I'll share some of my personal experiences and connections. First of all, it was noteworthy to me to see just how involved so many of my guests were. They're not just doing one thing, got several balls they're juggling. You heard it from Andrew, who's got several projects lined up while he's also helping at the film festival. Jason is the same way. He's working the festival. He's an AD. He's helping to write tax legislation for his home state of North Dakota. And then Alexander, he's got 3 films at the festival, and he's got his own film festival. I used to think these kinds of things were anomalies, but now as I get to know people more, it seems like the people who succeed are the people who are willing to invest their time in all kinds of projects and even give back. There was a lot of talk about giving back, about mentoring others, training others. And so that's encouraging to see. Chesley mentioned it in her discussion. She talks about how she thinks about connecting others, not herself, about making connections for other people so that they can benefit. It was like Jason's phrase, lateral success, like we can all succeed together if we all grow together. It's an appealing approach. So we got to hear from the different positions, some of them. I was also hoping to get the programming director on board, but we couldn't get that interview set. So some things to consider based on what we heard. And the positions are going to vary a little bit, but here's what I noticed for this festival. Operations director, Andrew in this case, he's the person contacting the filmmakers about their film. So he might have some sense of what the film's involved and what the personalities of the different filmmakers are like. He might be able to make an introduction if you say, hey, do you know someone who's got a film that's sort of like mine? Would be great to talk to that person. I did get to talk to Ian, the programming director, on the side, and we had a conversation about the nuances of the lineup. So if you find a programming director at LIFF or any festival in general, they are the ones who think very carefully about the lineup, balancing it, giving variety for people. They are often connected to the festival circuit and can talk about how a film progresses from one festival to another. So if they have time, they might be able to give you recommendations of what to check out. You say, hey, I like films from this director. Do you have anything going on at the festival that might be a good fit? Someone like Jason, the production director, is one of the most busy during the festival. He's running around with his team, trying to make sure everything's on time. He's sort of like the first AD of the film festival, keeping everything in line, making sure everything's on schedule and so on. So it was tricky finding a spare time to talk to him, but we were able to set something up after the festival, and I'm grateful to him for that. On a related note, he was the one that was most precise about when we would meet, not at 12:15 or 12:30, but 12:07, I believe, or something around that, a very precise time and very precise time for the interview, which is great. I mean, that's what you want to see from a first AD or a production director who's on top of it and has a lot to manage. Then you have the executive director of the festival, like Chesley, who has the big picture view, often doing a lot of the high profile things like spending time with the special guests and so on. They tend to be pretty busy as well, but you might be able to run into them after a screening or at the after party and get recommendations from them as well. At least for LIFF, the production director is also someone who helps schedule media interview requests. That can vary from festival to festival. Some will have a special press group. But so it's helpful to know. Sometimes just having those conversations can help you find the right film or maybe find someone at the festival who is in a similar place. And it sounds like the festival actually cares about encouraging those things. I mean, think about it. You go to a festival, you connect with someone, it leads to something that's a success story for them. It happened like that for Andrew. He was working over at the event they did at Sundance, the Bayou Burlesque special party that they put together at Sundance, and he was able to connect with his now business partner. That's really what festivals can do. I used to think, okay, it's a chance to get exposed to new things, and it is. You're going to get to see films and meet people that you wouldn't normally see or meet, but I think the value goes beyond that. It's about strengthening the relationships of people you already know. There's so much going on. Films deal with broad range of topics, and if you find something there to connect, you can strengthen that relationship. Just one example, I got to run into Alexander. I enjoyed seeing him. I've done interviews with him in the past for my LA Film Prize coverage. So if you want to hear more about his film memoir, you can check out the LA Film Prize 2016 coverage that I did last year. I'll link to that in the show notes. But seeing him again, it strengthened that connection we had. And then shortly thereafter, he reached out to me about his crowdfunding campaign that he was doing for his film. And I was receptive. I was glad to be involved because I felt like I had a better sense of who he was. Sometimes furthering relationships is more valuable, right? Do you want to have lots of relationships on a surface level? Hey, great to see you. Here's my card. All right, got to go. More cards to give out. I mean, how valuable is that going to be? And, you know, you do that. You meet people. You say hello. You share cards. All right. But the connections that have really mattered to me are the ones where I get to know certain people a little better. And from seeing them several times, I start thinking, I want to work with these people, or I want to get to know these people better. I want to be friends with these people. Now, every now and then, a festival will also show you that maybe you don't want to get to know someone. There are negative moments. It comes up. I mean, people are drinking. There's that rowdiness. There's that energy to go and connect. You got to go and network. You got to make the next big cool impression. Well, that can have a negative impact. So it didn't happen a lot for me, but there were one or two encounters where I said, that was disappointing, that encounter. I want to spend a little less time with this person as a result. I mean, it's something that can happen, so just be mindful of that. Overall, though, it was a positive festival experience for me. And on the production side, it seemed like it's a step above what they've been doing in the past. The only change they made that didn't work so well for me was the assigned seating at the festival. Possibly that's due to the way the theater they're in handles tickets. They now have assigned seats at the theater as well. But the thing about film festivals is there's a higher amount of spontaneity involved where you're hanging out with people and you might decide just 5 or 10 minutes before screening, let me go see what I can catch. Or you get out of a film and you find out there's another one that is just starting to play. You want to go in and get a seat. Now, there were a couple of times at the festival this year where I sat down and I inadvertently sat in someone's seat, even though I came to the screening maybe 5 minutes after the start time. And I had picked a seat in the back that I thought was out of the way. So then you have to try to get up and walk over people and find something else that's open. And then there was another instance when I actually sat in the right seat that was assigned to me on the ticket, but someone else was sitting there who was a VIP, and that was a little awkward. So I'd really prefer not to have assigned seating at a film festival. Well, with that out of the way, let me tell you a little bit more about some of the things I saw at the festival. I want to preface this by saying I didn't get to enjoy the full experience at the festival. I was coming from training for Canon. They sent me back to Virginia to train on some of the new equipment like the C700. And honestly, I wasn't sure that I was even going to be able to attend even a little bit, but we were able to make it work. The festival reached out to me to see if I would be interested in doing coverage. And to be honest, I was a little bit worn out from my festival coverage of South by Southwest, which was just a few weeks ago. So for any other festival, I probably would have said no, but Louisiana International Film Fest has a special place in my heart. It is, in fact, where my podcast started. It started a few years ago when I met Dana Boisso at a workshop she gave at LIFF, and we connected and she agreed to do the podcast. So it started there, and I've met a number of the people who I've collaborated with through the festival, like Andrew. So I said, sure, I'll be glad to come and try to do what coverage I can, even though I can't attend everything. So I was only able to attend a couple of days. This isn't going to be as thorough as some of my other festival coverages, but I think it'll give you some flavor of the overall feel and maybe some notable things. I didn't get to see Patty Cakes here at LIFF. I saw it at South by Southwest. It is a crowd pleaser. You can hear my take on that film on the South by coverage. And I should also add, most of my guests I interviewed also really liked it. Just for the sake of brevity, I didn't want to do several people saying, oh yeah, Patty Cakes was really great. It's worth seeing. It'll be coming out in the summer, made by a Louisiana production company, the Motion Picture Company, they're called. So keep an eye out for it. The first film I saw was Obit, a documentary about the writers at the New York Times who write obituaries. That was notable to me that it happened to be the first film I saw, because overall it felt to me like there was an acknowledgement of mortality in this year's film festival, more so than usual. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. As you've heard a couple of our prior guests discuss, the festival lost Dan Ireland last year, and they made a point of honoring him this year. So that's front and center. But there was also the unprecedented flooding in Southeast Louisiana that caused a lot of damage and some deaths. The festival could have ignored those things and provided mere escapist entertainment, but that's not what they did. They acknowledged in meaningful ways the hurts of their community and of their organization, and that is worth applauding. And it's also something that helped me get a better sense of what the festival is like. I've been attending a couple years now, but I'm just now starting to get a feel for how the Louisiana International Film Festival has its own personality, separate from other festivals. It's influenced by other festivals like Sundance, clearly, as we discuss, but it's starting to take on its own distinct essence. One way they did that was with the giant 3D printed boots that they had at the festival headquarters. And it ties into the distinctly rainy climate here in Louisiana. They do it in other ways. The way they use Louisiana food and culture and music and bring it into their lineup. But anyway, there was that sense of mortality in the things I saw. Not just in Obit, but in most of them, most of the films I saw actually had that in some way, where a character was deeply affected by death, acknowledging it. So let's talk more about Obit, some of the discussions that come up. There's a debate about who is worthy of the obituary, whose life has value enough for the newspaper to cover it, and why, what criteria are they using to make those decisions? It was an intriguing look at a world we don't know about. Most of us don't. And that is sometimes enough to make a documentary work, that special view into an esoteric world. It wasn't a perfect film, had some pacing issues. It seems like a lot of it involved talking heads right at the camera. It was such an intriguing view that I went with it. I will say I was amused that they included an exotic dancer in there, both the New York Times and the film, which goes to show that even the New York Times is not above a little titillation for their readers. I mean, I personally wouldn't want to be the one who has to explain. Well, yeah, we did choose to include the exotic dancer in the obituary. not the lieutenant governor who volunteers weekly at the food bank and who is a deacon at his church. I don't know the particulars. I'm just saying they did include it in that. Gave them an excuse to show a scantily clad girl dancing around. So she had more significance to the Times and the film than the dedicated Sunday school teacher and volunteer at whatever. But so it goes. You know, you got to sell papers and you got to sell movies sometimes. So you do these things. But there were a couple of times where I felt like the movie was going to end. I wasn't sure. And so along those lines, filmmakers, if you're trying to get feedback for your work, that might be one question to ask. Was there ever a point where you felt like this film was about to end and it didn't? If it feels like it's three or four times where you're expecting the ending and it's not there, that probably suggests an issue with the structure of your story. But anyway, it is an intriguing view, so I'd recommend it if you happen to see it. Another documentary at the film festival that acknowledges death, is very well aware of mortality, is One Note at a Time. You heard the interview for that one at the beginning of this episode. And in the film, you have a couple of musicians ruminating about death in New Orleans. One musician in particular said that no one in the city is afraid to die, something they talk about more freely than other places. That surprised me. I didn't realize that. I mean, I guess there is that aspect of it. It sort of goes hand in hand with the celebration, like, hey, let's eat, drink, and be merry because tomorrow you might die. There is that. It was striking to me to see these musicians and the community they have. That was one of the most powerful aspects of it. This musicians' clinic is coming together, trying to provide them health services to fill the void that other institutions aren't providing. There was some politics here, but I didn't feel like the film took cheap shots, and it felt very even-handed. It was more about exploring these musicians and the hurts they're facing and the clinic that's trying to help them rather than demonizing certain policy members. As we said earlier, it does seem like the Musicians Clinic is doing good work. If you're looking to get involved to make a donation, I'll include a link for them in the show notes. Another music documentary I got to see at the festival was The Book of Clarence, which explores the life of Clarence Fountain. He's the Grammy-winning artist who is a big part of the Blind Boys of Alabama. Now, I want to mention that I had an interview with one of the musicians from that film as well, but unfortunately that data got corrupted on my recorder. I'm usually paying attention to how I back things up, but with the hustle and bustle of the film festival, that doesn't always happen. So I apologize about that. I need to think about ways of backing up data even on site for festivals. So anyway, that's another film where I was captivated by it because the subject was so compelling, in particular the charisma of Clarence and his sense of faith. He was blinded at a young age, and yet he still has a sense of faith. It is moving to see how deep his faith is, in spite of the discrimination he's faced, in spite of the blindness. He does have moral clarity more than a lot of us. And that's inspiring. And it was inspiring to see it in him as well. He was there. He actually gave a discussion, part of a Q&A. And in that discussion too, he was talking about the importance of listening to God, finding clarity and doing the right thing. And there are those people you run into who have that kind of moral fortitude, and it comes from a place of strength. It seems like it flows from all of their experiences. It's not something put upon. It's not something that felt like it was a contrivance that he said. So that made the film compelling. You have music, again, tying into the regional interest of music. You've got faith intersecting with race and prejudice. So these are all intriguing topics, and they work well together. Now, that said, I wish they had paid a little bit more attention to some of the little details. I'm not trying to nitpick here. It's just an observation. This might be helpful to some of you as well. There are a lot of fonts out there. Papyrus. Let's maybe think about other fonts beyond Papyrus. Yes, they used it in Avatar. They did some lighting to it. And they have some pretty high-end effects, so people can maybe forgive Papyrus. But it doesn't make the best of impressions to those of us who do pay attention to design elements. If you think it's just me, look it up. Search Papyrus in movie titles. So why does that matter? Well, the title is often the thing that people work on last. They've got to get the movie poster done. They've got to get it ready. They work so hard on the film and doing the interviews, but it's often the first thing that we see when we're trying to decide what films to go check out. And I have found, just as a rule of thumb, if the font is generic or something like Papyrus or some of the other ones that are used way too often, then that will speak in some way to the level of quality that the film has. And along those lines, there were some distracting graphical elements, let's say. Now, I am not someone who makes a living doing compositing, breaking down green screens and combining elements. I've done the bare minimum, the basics. I've done it a few times. I could spot the issues on almost all of the green screen elements they used. And that shouldn't be the case when I have such a basically entry level, just a step above entry level in that field. It's not like I'm a compositor working for Industrial Light and Magic, and I'm not going to films looking to pick them apart, but you could see the edges of the composition and it looked distracting. What I would suggest to filmmakers is maybe you don't have the resources to bring in someone who is exceptionally trained in those areas. That's fine. But at the very least, ask someone who has experience in that, someone who does graphics, just say, what do you think of this? I am confident that anyone who has done any kind of compositing work, even watched 20 minutes worth of a tutorial, would be able to spot the issues. And they were ongoing. It's not like it was one or two shots. It was pervasive. The kind of things they say, hey, watch out for this, because you're going to see this kind of color bleed, or you're going to see these details start to swim. If they had done that, I would imagine they would have said, yeah, look, these are issues you're running into. It's not going to take too much more work to fix this. And it would dramatically improve the perception of your film. Now, again, it's still a film I recommend, but if they had spent a little bit more time on that, then I could have really gotten behind it. I would have said, wow, this film does justice to this great man, this Grammy-winning artist. And for someone so accomplished, you want it to have that same polish, right? You want to do credit to the big personality that you're profiling. And one way you can do that is by paying attention to the detail. So still worth seeing, but if you're like me, you might find yourself cringing at times at some of the motion graphic choices. But, you know, get through it and you might get a nice substantive meal. I would have liked to have seen the Ryan Francis story, but by the time I started hearing about it, tickets were already nowhere to be found. But that's another film that dealt with mortality. Ryan Francis was a likable USC basketball player with a lot of potential and then tragically gunned down, and So the film explores that story, asks those questions. Why did he have to die? At least that's what I gather from what I've seen and read of. I do hope to catch it at some point soon. Another film that dealt with mortality was the closing film, The Hero, where you have this aging Western movie star with a contemplative performance by Sam Elliott. When he gets diagnosed with cancer, he starts reflecting on his life and what it means. During the film, he gets a Lifetime Achievement Award. But the film caused that to question. Was he really doing something heroic, being this film star, playing the hero? What kind of guy was he really? And you get to see maybe not such a hero to his daughter, who is hurt by his ongoing absence. But he gets the achievement award. He would probably make it into the New York Times obituary. Is that achievement, though, really? Is that really what we want to aim for? Who knows? I mean, he does spend some time trying to reconnect, trying to find those personal connections. It's another film that's worth seeing. That one, very polished film, thoughtful. And then there is the film Cezanne and I, which also deals with a sense of mortality, at least the way that a certain death can affect someone, the strength of that relationship. You know, I'll tell you, I was surprised that I liked that film as much as I did. I went into the film already interested because it's a fictionalized retelling of Paul Cézanne and his friendship with the writer Émile Zola. I enjoy Paul Cézanne's paintings, one of the post-impressionists that I admire. So I was looking forward to seeing the film. And he has this beautiful color palette that he uses. Shows up a couple times in the film. But the film has a notable amount of nudity, more so than I typically prefer. I'm not so prudish that I will object to a film just because there's nudity, but if there's a lot of it, that's usually a turn off for me because it generally feels gratuitous. In this case here, it didn't. Part of it is they are painters and they are painting beautiful women and they are beautifully lit, so it is very suggestive at times. I guess that's to say I'm not a one-issue moviegoer, folks. Sometimes I will make allowances, but the film has to have really strong elements to counterbalance that. Otherwise, I'm like, oh, come on. You didn't want to blow up the building as well and then bring in the beautiful naked harem right after? But that's not what the film does. The power of it for me is the strength of the relationship and how complicated it is. And also the way that art isn't held up on the pedestal. It's like they made a deliberate point of taking it out and getting it muddy amidst the people. You have these great artists who know each other and they have friendships, but there is also rivalry and there's this competition, jealousy, sometimes pettiness. Oh, I can't believe he got that thing. Why did he get it? I should have gotten it. If you know artists, if you're an artist, maybe you can identify with that because it's not always so pristine. And they even have one scene in the film where they are riding to this museum on this muddy wagon with this well-known painting, as if it's like, we just got to get it carted in with the ox. We got to get this thing. Striking contrast to how those kind of paintings are handled today with pristine care, worth millions. They have an entire team that is so meticulous in moving it from one area to another. So it is a bit of a send up to the art world, the stuffiness of it. And this had vitality. It felt like they are creating with fire and purpose and that all of their essence is going into the work they're doing. And the work means so much, at least to them. But then it doesn't get the reception they hoped it would. In particular, Cezanne is devastated one night when he happens to be in a position where he can overhear his supposed friends discussing his work and its second-rate qualities, laughing at it. It's devastating. There's a line that I wrote down because it just so relates. As best as I could write it at the time, it goes something like this. An artist is a guy who lives in a dump for a minute of applause. Yeah, ouch, that hits home a little bit, right? Again, if you're an artist, maybe you face similar things, but you do feel for him. And his relationship with Emile Zola, who seems to be his best friend, is complicated. They say of him in regards to Cezanne, with you, I never know if I'm dealing with a dog, a cobra, or a butterfly. It's that tumultuous. Putting that kind of a complex, fiery relationship on screen in a believable way is quite an accomplishment. They pulled it off in this film. Similar to the hero film that we discussed earlier, this film is wondering whether the artist who retreats from the world in pursuit of his art is doing a good or bad thing. And this film goes even further than the hero in suggesting that the artist can occasionally be a monster who denies love or is incapable of love for his art. And is that a good thing? But it's in his blood. It seems like that's what he can do, and he doesn't know how to do it any other way. In other words, is it inherently tragic when the artist retreats from his society to create his art, or is it some kind of public service? Hard to say, but it's an interesting dilemma, one that the film explores. Just as a word of caution, though, there's a notable amount of nudity, suggestive nudity, not just statues of Michelangelo's David and other art. It's suggestive. So this is probably not the film to share with your art appreciation high school class, okay? And, you know, there were times when I was watching it when I got some ideas. As one of my friends might say, Bad Nick was getting too much influence.
Well, maybe I'll just go and say something suggestive to her, see what happens.
Don't worry, nothing suggestive was said. Probably helps that I wasn't drinking. So if this is the film that you're showing at your Wednesday wine mixer, there could be repercussions, right? I'm just saying. But, you know, it comes with the art world, I guess. That has been a part of it. Artists painting beauty and the like. But I'll tell you, it's when the film's perspective about the artist far from love was most persuasive, that's when I was most inclined to be less than noble. And it's interesting, isn't it? The way that sex can become more alluring when love seems further away. I do want to believe in love, that there's something to be said about saving sexual gratification for committed, loving relationships. It's a nice ideal. And I want to believe that it does work. For others, at least. I'm not sure if it works for me. I'm not sure. But I hope so. I do hope that I can make it work someday. At least on my better days when Bad Nick isn't too influential. Anyway, that brings me to my favorite film of the festival, The Whole Wide World. Now, I want to preface that by saying I didn't get to see everything. I didn't get to see Kills on Wheels, The Red Pill, some other stuff. Limited time at the festival. I can assure you I'm not just saying it because it's Dan Ireland's film. Going into the film, I was actually thinking, what's going to happen if I don't like this film? How am I going to deal with that? I wouldn't be the jerk who would go into details about why I didn't like it, but I would probably just gloss over it. It's not my style to falsely praise something that doesn't connect. I would maybe try to find the thing that I like or phrase something in a very strategic way, but I couldn't really bring myself to outright embrace something that didn't work for me. It's just the style of my show. I mean, if you hear the show, you've probably heard me say things where I would probably get the guests full-on support. It's mostly positive, and then I'll say one or two things. The guests will think, well, I can't really agree with this thing that you said. I'm not going to share it. Instead, I'm going to share some secrets on weight loss. Okay? It's the blessing or curse that comes with being me. What can I say? But anyway, Dan's film, it was one that really did resonate with me. That's not to say the film is entirely without flaw. Like Obit, there were times where I was starting to suspect that the end was near, only to have the film continue for a bit longer. That happened a couple of times. So maybe some refining on the structure might help with that. But overall, I like the film quite a bit. It's a kind of film where the worlds of two very different people collide. On the one hand, you have Noveline Price, an aspiring writer and school teacher played by Renee Zellweger. On the other hand, you have a writer of pulp fiction stories, Robert E. Howard, played by Vincent D'Onofrio. And it's set in the Midwest. They're both from the Midwest. But it's almost like a clash of values between the urbanites that fly coast to coast, consider the Midwest to be flyover country. Oh yeah, I got big things going, baby. Gonna fly out to Cali and then back. Gonna pass through flyover country, though. What am I gonna do then? Maybe I'll watch that new critically acclaimed torture porn film. And then you have Midwest values. Now, lest you think I'm just reading into that, let me give you some actual quotes from the film. This is Renee Zellweger's character. In all earnestness, she says to Robert, "I'm sorry, but I don't see anything sexy about a naked woman dancing on a pirate ship." Now, come to think of it, I would really like the opportunity to use that line at some point. I don't know when, like maybe at some kind of pirate putt-putt theme night. Something, okay? I would like this opportunity, but it does speak to the tension between them. Robert is excited about writing those kind of, some might say sexy, some might say exploitative stories. And Noveline is repulsed by it. At one point, she's speculating about what might happen if Robert's kind of stories become more prominent. She's saying, like, what? Are we going to see entertainment that's filled with rapes and murders? Yeah, what would that be like, right? The film is set in 1933 when there was more of a sense of innocence with everyone. So much so that one of the characters says a mild swear word and those around her are so shocked that she would say something, even a mild swear word, even once. In contrast, these days we go to the mall, and if we don't hear someone casually dropping the F-bomb out and about, we get this sense that something's not quite right, something's amiss. This doesn't feel like a typical day. What's going on? Ah, progress. It is so very nice. Another occasion when she's having an argument with Robert, he's accusing her of being small-minded and bigoted, typical of a small-town resident. And she responds by saying, "Just because you're poor and work hard doesn't mean you're hateful." Sounds familiar to anyone? Like maybe the kind of rhetoric we heard around election time from certain people who despised not the candidate, but the people who voted for him, who disagreed with them, fellow Americans. Just can't believe how naive and morally repugnant some of those so-called Americans are. Now, if you'll excuse me, I've got to go watch The Killers and the Porn Queens. I've seen every episode because it's so good. Yeah, so there is that discrepancy. Now, to be fair, the film does give weight to Robert's side of things. He's energetic. He has charm. He's trying to do something new. Doesn't want to get caught in the old ways of doing things. So it's not like the deck is stacked against his point of view, but it does seem like the film leans toward Noveline's perspective. Specifically, you look at the pacing. It unfolds in a leisurely way, like sitting on the porch, getting to know your neighbors kind of way. It stands in contrast to the films that have a much more frenetic pace. The kinds of films you see set in the modern urban cities. And this film was made a couple of years ago, but not that long ago. It was 1996, around the time when Tarantino's Pulp Fiction came out. And this film is no Pulp Fiction. Probably the thing that resonates the most with me about that movie is the way that Renee's character has weight. Her point of view is not easily dismissed. She is a decent character who seems to be an earnest representation, an unironic representation of goodness. And she is able to hold her own against the more abrasive, more energetic, more modern outlook of Vincent D'Onofrio. And that is so rare. And to be honest, it's hard for me to believe sometimes in reality. How can goodness hold a candle to the depravity of all the screwed up things out there? I mean, you don't have to search very far to see crooked things, ugly things in our world, or even in ourselves, even in myself. I don't have to look very far to see those things. I don't have doubts about humanity's potential for depravity, vice. That's pretty self-evident to me. I do wonder sometimes if decency has any chance in hell at surviving this crazed modern landscape of ours. And in the film, there's the suggestion that it does, perhaps not right away, but that it can over time. It can make impact. So honestly, of all the things that I saw there, that was the one that most resonated with the things that I'm wrestling with, that reminded me of what I wanted to be reminded of, needed to be reminded of. I don't know. But it made an impression, and I'm grateful for that. In reading up on the Whole Wide World film, I discovered that it was actually the film that helped Renee Zellweger get Jerry Maguire. It turns out that her agent sent the film to Cameron Crowe, and that was a deciding factor as he was considering her for Dorothy Boyd in his film. At least that's what Wikipedia says. And Jerry Maguire is another film that had a pretty big influence on me. Why am I mentioning that here? Well, as sometimes happens on this show, there are connections to the things that come up in the interviews and some notable aspects of my life, notable moments of my life. And this is no exception. The first time I saw Jerry Maguire in its entirety, I was there studying abroad for a semester while in college. And it was a discouraging day. And I had the sense that there was something I was supposed to see as I was flipping through the channels. Got to Jerry Maguire. It felt like that was it. That was what I needed to see. Which felt a little odd. Why do I need to see this right now? I'm in London. Why do I need to see this thing? It's got a superstar in it. It's going to be a typical Hollywood sort of thing. I thought, that's what I thought. So I thought, well, that's fine, but I can see that some other time. When I'm back in the United States, no, it felt like I should watch. And I did. And something about that film really touched a nerve. I mean, maybe it's because Jerry is this character who works really hard, but he struggles with intimacy. His own relationships, those don't always work out. But in the film, there was a way in which they did. In a few key moments of his life. In Jerry Maguire, Renee Zellweger once again plays a beacon of decency. In fact, you could even say that the belief that Renee Zellweger's character, Dorothy Boyd, has in Jerry Maguire is what allows him and Cuba Gooding Jr. to transform. At the beginning of the film, Jerry has a dark night of the soul and because of that, or maybe because he's thinking about his father, who he wanted to be, he writes a mission statement that goes beyond the kind of person he is at the time. He's reaching forward with idealism. He's not quite there, but he writes it. And she is the first person who believes in it. And perhaps because of that, he's able to go on that long journey. Because of her belief in him, he goes on the long journey. And the idealism of that mission statement transforms them all. And seeing that film made me believe in the possibility of love, not just in general, but even in my own world. Usually that doesn't happen. It's not the kind of thing that works out typically, but it made me believe, what if it could? Maybe it can. Looking back on how things unfolded, I now realize that seeing Jerry Maguire was that little bit of encouragement that I needed to try to make things work with this girl in London. And it was the first time I believed that the L word could actually apply. Not right away, but eventually. Like, there could be possibility there. She was the first girl who made me believe in magic, made me believe that anything was possible. There was one night in particular where it felt so close to happening. We really did have that sense of possibility and connection between us. And to be honest, if I could go back and relive any day in my life, it would be that day, because I felt so hopeful and the world was filled with such possibility. Things didn't work out with the girl, but little brief moments we had together were enough to inspire me. I was able to write my first screenplay, feature-length screenplay, because she had been a part of my life in some small way. And for the first time, my stories had a sense of warmth to them. It's convoluted, but it was there. It usually wasn't. And that was the little spark, the motivation that kept me going, trying to make it work in the film industry. All these years, even now, it's probably still an influence. It definitely brought me to where I'm at now. So it was notable to me that the first interview I did was with someone from London. Barry Martin is born in London. It's not just that. The day when Renee Zellweger made her appearance, when the film The Whole Wide World was shown, and when she gave the Dan Ireland Award, it was April 23rd, which anyone who listens to the show knows that number has a certain significance. It keeps showing up in some way. That was the day she was there. I had reached out to the festival to see if we could make an interview happen. It seemed like Renee had a lot going on, but still wanted to say hello. I was nearby, and we made eye contact. Now, once again, I had some trepidation. I reached out to others, people I looked up to, and things haven't always worked out. It creates dissonance, and I've learned that sometimes even the people who are involved in things that are really inspiring to me don't always live up to my expectations or hopes when I meet them in person. That creates a kind of dissonance where I say, well, I can choose to disregard their work entirely, or say, well, their work still inspires me, even if they don't as a person. So I was a little nervous. And with my more aggressive outreaches at South by Southwest, trying to connect with some of these high-profile people who were there, still a little worn out from that. I was a little more hesitant, but I saw her. We made eye contact, and she seemed friendly enough. It was every time I had a chance to try to get closer, security detail would move her to another area where she had other things scheduled. But she didn't seem like she was in a rush. She seemed like she was open to engaging those around her. From everything I saw and heard, she was quite the person. Possibly she is even more compelling in person than in the role she plays. everyone said that she acted in such a gracious way to her. And I didn't see anything to contradict that. And, you know, seeing her graciousness was another little thing that helped me share this. I would have been more comfortable not sharing it. I would have slept a little easier if I just did the straightforward discussion. Maybe one of these days I will, just to make it easier. Like, saw lots of great films, lots of great events, all kinds of exciting possibilities. Things are just, maybe I'll do that for one of these episodes where I cover the festival. But this time, there are enough little things to get me to do this version for whatever it's worth. It's interesting how it works, those little things, and how they can have big, big impact. It's that little feeling that I should watch Jerry Maguire that changed my time in London, which changed my life and brought me here. It's that little moment of connection. Louisiana International Film Festival all those years ago with Dana Boisseau made me think I could do a podcast. It was seeing Renee, where she interacted, seeing the film, that made me more inclined to share this. A couple of other little moments at work that made this version of the episode possible. I had submitted my film, Trent's War, to Louisiana International Film Festival a couple of years ago, and it didn't get in, which in retrospect is not all that surprising because it didn't get in anywhere. It wasn't quite up to par. It wasn't quite what it should be. And I can realize that now in retrospect, but I couldn't see it at the time. And so there's something about the way that I found out. I can't remember the details, but it hurt my feelings a little bit. And so I was ready to step away from the festival. Say, all right, I'm going to keep my distance because it hurt. And when you're in the midst of the production, you spend so much time and effort on things and it doesn't work, it stings. And honestly, as filmmakers, we have only so many shots at bat. If you work hard on something, it takes a long time, a bit of money to make happen, and it doesn't connect, then you can only keep trying a couple more times, and then you're going to be full of self-doubts. Others are going to be full of doubts. And it's going to become more difficult to get the resources you need and the team you need to make any film happen. And so it was something that weighed on me at the time. But I reached out to Jason Allen, and to his credit, he responded to me in a gracious way, probably more gracious than I deserved. And he took the time to acknowledge the way I felt and to respond to me, which is not something everyone would do. Some people might say, well, you know, we're very busy. We don't have time to do this. So it turns out the thing that I was discouraged by wasn't a deliberate slight by the festival, just a misunderstanding. And that made me feel a little better. That little encounter was what made it possible for me to re-engage and reconnect with the festival after that. And it was one of the little things that led to this, whatever this is. Some other little things that led to this as well. At the festival, I saw not just Andrew Vogel, but Matthew Yerby. He was a producer on another film that was at the festival, The Stand, and he was the other main actor in Trent's War, along with Andrew Vogel. And talking about Trent's War is something that's still difficult for me, but it felt appropriate to do, in part because I saw others talking about similarly difficult things for them at the festival. I mean, even Chesley was talking about how she suffers from this illness, chronic fatigue syndrome, or the other names. Not something I knew about her, not something she had to share, but she did. It's more interesting, I think, when we come together as a community and acknowledge the things that we're struggling with, the things that really hurt in some way. Not the kinds of things we always want to talk about, but sometimes a film festival can bring about that conversation. Little things that can make all the difference. Seeing Renee on the 23rd of all days helped. And you know, that's not the only time the number came up. Turns out Barry Martin was born on February 23rd. I realized that in doing the research for this. And another more solemn instance of that number related to current events. The tragic attack at Ariana Grande's concert happened just a day before I was ready to post this. And that happened over in the UK. And it turns out Ariana is 23 years old, which was unsettling. And so my heart goes out to the victims of that. I thought about not publishing this, but I was already planning to discuss this. It's just, it now has a weightier feel. But just because something is tragic doesn't mean we should avoid discussing it or referencing it. That was something that Louisiana International Film Festival made very evident to me this year. Maybe being able to discuss the deep personal things that might hurt quite a bit can be the road back to celebration. If not now, then eventually. Maybe, just maybe, that can help to make the world a little better if we give it enough time. In conclusion, I want to bring it back to Dan. A majority of the people I interviewed for this episode had such affirming things to say about Dan. Made me wish I had gotten the chance to know him a little better. In her interview with The Advocate, Renee Zellweger spoke of Dan as being a walking celebration of life, kindness personified. Dan was just good, she said. In the Q&A for The Whole Wide World, the screenwriter Michael Scott Myers said of Dan, he was like Willy Wonka and magic followed him everywhere. Dan achieved so much in his lifetime as a filmmaker, co-founder of the Seattle International Film Festival, key influence in the Louisiana International Film Festival, and so many other things. The kinds of things that even the newspaper obituaries would take note of. But it's more than that. It's the kind of effect that he had on the people he worked with, that so many people would want to come together and honor him, even a year after his passing, speaks volumes. You heard a number of the people I interviewed talk about how Dan was a mentor figure who was there when they were taking new steps and encouraged them to take on new challenges that they hadn't done before and do them with excellence. To have that kind of impact on so many is such an admirable thing. If only more of us could have that kind of impact, it might not seem so unlikely that decency could prevail in the world at large. Maybe someday. All right, and that's my coverage of Louisiana International Film Fest 2017. What are your thoughts? Did you get to attend the festival? Any highlights that stuck out for you? If so, it would be great to hear about them. You can leave a comment on the show page or shoot me an email. It's podcast@ncivitis.com. And again, don't forget that we will possibly be releasing Trent's War in a limited way in June. So if you want to be on top of when that happens, let me know and I'll make sure to keep you posted. You can also find details for the things we discussed on the show notes. So maybe it's just a matter of noting the films you want to catch later or find links. Look for them on the page. Music for the show, beginning in the end, provided by Rob Coslow. It's the song True Gemini. If something about the show resonated with you in some way, then it's possible that it will also resonate with someone you know. Would you consider sharing it with that person? He or she might really appreciate it, and that could actually strengthen your friendship. I'd appreciate it too. Or you could just show your support by leaving a nice comment, a nice review on iTunes. Gratitude feels good. And it's one of those little things that we can all do to encourage the fight for better things in others. Remember, little things sometimes can have a big, big impact. Until next time, let's make our future collaborations be better collaborations. And go, go, work it, work it, work it.
Oh, we're just keeping it classy, Nick, one day at a time.
I like it. See, there you go. That's an NCVD's podcast closer.